Hello, Dove, and everyone. Yeah, I'm happy to be back again. We're here for the continuation of this week's Seven Steps to Awakening. And today we're going to begin on quote 173. So let me get that link for you. For anybody listening on the radio, what you want to do is go to RDA7, that is the digit 7, not spelled out, RDA7stepsjournal.wordpress.com. Again, that is RDA7stepsjournal.wordpress.com. We're on step 1, so up on the menu bar you'll see a step 1. Just click on that. And then click on the series of numbers that will allow you to find your way to 173. And go ahead and find your way to 173 under step 1, and that's where we're going to begin today. What I would like to do before we begin is just take a moment of silence. Something inside me said, yay! So let's just do that now, okay? Amen. All right, so I'm going to begin by reading from the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening. I am on page 41, and the quotes that we are reading right now come from another book called The Supreme Yoga. And I'm going to read quote number 173. One's limited understanding and one's own notions are the cause of bondage, and liberation is their absence. Hence, abandon all notions. All right, let's go ahead and go to the journal. Typically, I read them twice, but when I checked, there was just a go ahead, so we'll go ahead. So I'm looking at number 173 in the journal. And it says, if I am feeling a sense of bondage now, where is that sense of bondage coming from? It is coming from the thoughts I am listening to and believing now. Somebody's here, but I think Jamie will answer the door. I'm sure it's Ruby. She said she was coming over. So again, if I am feeling a sense of bondage now, where is that sense of bondage coming from? It is coming from the thoughts I am listening to and believing now. To be free from this present sense of bondage, free my attention from these thoughts. Return attention to the heart and ask for its current moment guidance. In its current moment guidance, I find freedom. In its current moment guidance, I am presently free. Hello, Miss Ruby.
Hello.
How are you?
Doing fine.
Good. We're on number 173.
Okay.
All right. I'm already reading it, so I've already read from the book. But I'm just about to discuss the journal entry. So, you know, it's funny because I paused to look at what to say about this, and what came up was, well, this is just true. This is just true. And in fact, it's so true that you can test it. If I have unhappiness in me now, it is literally because of the thoughts that I am believing in this second. So If I am looking at a face and not liking that personality that I, you know, that I put with that face, you know, I'm feeling something that isn't peace, joy, love, right? I'm feeling something else, some kind of dislike, maybe frustration, annoyance, whatever. And if I'm not alert, I will probably be mistaken and think that that face is the cause of my angst. But if I want to test this, then what I can do is notice the thoughts in my mind about this personality. And I can choose to see them as only thoughts, not true. And I can choose, even just as an experiment, to put those thoughts completely aside and look at that face freshly. Look at that face with a welcoming sense. And in the moment that I do that, I'm going to feel differently. Now, if the face then says something, and that something fits the judgments I have about the personality, and I've not yet truly healed, I may in that instant go right back to my thoughts that I was right about that person, and go right back to my frustration or annoyance or whatever. But again, it's not because of what that face said. It's because I let that return me to my judgments. So really what I want to do then is I want to allow my judgments to be truly and permanently healed. So that no matter what that face says, those judgments do not return to my mind as beliefs, and therefore I never have to leave my peace. You know, and again, you know, when I share this stuff, the good news is I'm not just sharing theory, I'm sharing from experience. And, you know, I have healed regarding, you know, many faces, and you could say all faces, because there comes a point where that healing just transfers. But a key face was, of course, my beloved daughter, Jasmine. If you know me, you know that there was a time when I felt that she spoke to me or acted towards me disrespectfully a lot. And whenever that thought was in my mind that she was disrespecting me, there was a strong dislike. In fact, it would be fair to call it hatred. You know, in those moments, I hated her. But as this thought began to be seen in my mind, and I began to realize that the cause of that feeling of hatred was this thought that she's not respecting me, I started giving my willingness for that thought to be healed. And eventually that thought was healed completely. And I've mentioned to you all before that since then, whenever she behaves in, you know, similar ways, the judgment does not come back that she disrespects me because it's healed. Instead, a thought that really shows up all the time for me is that she's just being, right now, 15. Last year the thought would have been she's just being 14, or the year before she's just being 13, you know? That thought shows up instead, and that's a very benign thought for me. I mean, it has no emotion to it, so it doesn't disturb my peace. So you see, it's not the face. It's not what the face says or what the face does that causes me or you to suffer or feel bondage in any way. It is our thoughts, and that is always, always true. So the key then is to learn to allow our thoughts just to pass without attaching to them, without belief. Let them come and let them go without grabbing onto them. And then our peace is never disturbed. We're never in bondage. So, number 173 again. If I am feeling a sense of bondage now, where is that sense of bondage coming from? It is coming from the thoughts I am listening to and believing now. To be free from this present sense of bondage, free my attention from these thoughts. Return attention to the heart and ask for its current moment guidance. In its current moment guidance, I find freedom. In its current moment guidance, I am presently free. And I suppose that when I was asking for another way to see what appeared to be disrespect, what came up for me was just this, you know, she's just acting out the ego script of a 7-year-old and then an 8-year-old and then a 9-year-old. That was the, you know, that was the perception that came. And like I said, that was not a charged perception for me. So let's scroll down and click on number 174, which is on the left. I will also post the link to number 174 in the room. And I'm going to read number 174 from the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening. And it says, "The thought-free, notionless state is best. The thought-free, notionless state is best." Let's look at 174 in the journal. It is helpful to spend time focused on the thought-free heart each day while doing nothing else. The heart will guide you to sit with it for the right amount of time. The mind will guide you to avoid sitting or to strain to sit beyond your current natural tolerance. But the heart guides gently when, where, and how long to sit. Listen to the heart. Follow the heart and let nature take its course. So what's interesting is I think that, you know, many of us get the idea that we need to make the mind thought free. And my experience is instead of making the mind thought free, it's really more of a shift that occurs into what is already thought-free. In other words, there already is a thought-free beingness, isness. Now, we don't have to make the thought-free beingness. We just need to shift into it, maybe shift away from the mind. And here, of course, that thought-freeness is being called the heart, and that's a very typical symbol. And what this is recommending, in order to become really aware and tuned in to that thought-free beingness, which is our truth, instead of the constantly chattering mind, is it's recommending just to spend time every day with that. But what's really cool about this recommendation, I think, is it's not saying you should do this, you know, 15 minutes a day or 20 minutes a day or 30 minutes a day or an hour a day or 2 hours a day or 12 hours a day. It's saying the heart itself will guide you how long to do it. The heart itself knows your tolerance for how long you can sit in that thought-free space without being distracted. And you know, it's interesting because even if you sit with that thought-free space for 30 seconds, there's value in that because then the awareness of the thought-free space is present. There's no longer a believing that the thinking mind, the chattering mind, is all there is. You come to know yourself as the thought-free space. So it is helpful to take these breaks every day. You know, as the heart guides, when the heart guides. Bentino, I think, based on what I hear from friends who listen to him, he has a recommendation basically that you take this thought-free break for 3 to 5 seconds multiple times during the day. And my heart has a big yes to that, that is helpful. The teachings of Inner Ramana really had the same teaching. It worded it differently. The teachings of Inner Ramana recommended saying a mantra, but then it recommended staying in the stillness that followed the mantra. And that, again, was typically a few seconds, like Bentino recommends, but it was multiple times a day. So, it is helpful to spend time focused on the thought-free heart each day while doing nothing else. The heart will guide you to sit with it for the right amount of time. The mind will guide you to avoid sitting or to strain to sit beyond your current natural tolerance. But the heart guides gently when, where, and how long to sit. Listen to the heart, follow the heart, and let nature take its course. All right, so you can scroll down, and on the left you'll see a number 175. You can click on that. And I will also post the link in the room. All right. And I'm going to read number 175 from the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening, and this is what it says. You are deluded because you do not recollect repeatedly and frequently the truth concerning the infinite consciousness, but you partake of the poison of self-limitation and the consequent psychological conditioning. So, you know, it's funny because I went ahead and ordered the book, The Supreme Yoga, but, you know, I just put it on my shelf because, if you know, right now I'm not feeling guided to read anything but this book, The Seven Steps to Awakening. So I don't know the context of where these quotes come from. I don't know if it almost looks like a storybook, but I don't know for sure that it is a storybook. I don't know what it is yet. But if I thought that the Supreme Yoga was a person, I would think he was speaking to someone very specifically here, telling that person, you know, you don't spend enough time in the day focusing on self. You don't spend enough time in the day remembering whatever may have come to you during your morning contemplation or your morning meditation. You just go off getting caught up in the world again, and that is your problem. That's kind of what I hear in this. Again, I don't know the context, though, and maybe someday I will. But number 175 again says, you are deluded because you do not recollect repeatedly and frequently the truth concerning the infinite consciousness, but you partake of the poison of self-limitation and the consequent psychological conditioning. All right, let's look at number 175 in the journal. Oh, Dove is quoting Jesus here from A Course in Miracles. If you were not so tolerant of your mind wandering, you would not need my course. So there we go. Same idea. Teachers, I guess, say that, don't they? All right, here we go, number 175. Time, while it still appears to exist, can be an ally in awakening. Use time to focus on the heart. Use time to notice the truth of who you are. Use time to stay in touch with the guidance of the heart and to follow it lovingly, humbly, in present joy obedience. Mind wastes time. Heart embraces it. Spend time in embrace until the idea of time is no more. You know, so the first thought that comes to me as I read this is the Course in Miracles workbook. I would say this is one of the primary purposes of the Course in Miracles workbook, is to get us in the habit of using time for awakening instead of being distracted by the mind. In fact, we're on a review lesson today, and, you know, the review lesson is reviewing the thought, I rest in God, and the thought, I am as God created me, if I remember correctly. I'm not actually doing the workbook, because I'm doing the seven steps, but I think those were the two thoughts today. And what the review is asking you to do, well, you spent in the morning time 5 minutes meditating on the first thought, I rest in God. And in the evening, you spend 5 minutes meditating on the second thought, I am as God created me. But in between those 2 5-minute meditations, every half hour you say one or the other, rotating. So like maybe on the hour, you pause for a moment and you say, I rest in God. And then maybe on the half hour, you pause and say, I am as God created me. And of course, while I don't remember this being specific in the directions, the way that I always heard this, the way this was always interpreted to me, is that wasn't to be a swift, you know, oh God, it's the hour, I rest in God. Okay, now what were we talking about? It wasn't to be like that. It was always to be taking a moment to have a heartfelt pause. You know, very much like Bentino's 3 to 5 seconds. A heartfelt pause. I rest in God. All right, now what were we talking about? More like that, if that's how it needs to happen, right? So the teaching in the workbook is a teaching of practice using time for awakening instead of letting mind waste time with distraction. And of course, that was also the teaching of the teachings of Inner Ramana. That was the purpose of the mantra, to say the mantra every time the mind, or every time the memory of the mantra came into the mind, you would say the mantra lovingly with devotion and allow yourself to stay in the stillness that follows the mantra. That was also the purpose for me of those single quiet thoughts that came. You may remember, they're now called the thoughts of awakening, but you may remember that when they came, my guidance was to print them, cut them out, and keep them in my back pocket, and then pull them out multiple times a day and read them and contemplate them multiple times a day. So, you know, there's so many of these practices that are very similar in really just getting us in the habit of staying with the heart instead of going back to the mind. So number 175 again, time, while it still appears to exist, can be an ally in awakening. Use time to focus on the heart. Use time to notice the truth of who you are. Use time to stay in touch with the guidance of the heart and to follow it lovingly, humbly, in present joy, obedience. Mind wastes time. Heart embraces it. Spend time in embrace until the idea of time is no more. And I think that's beautiful. Ruby agrees. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so if you scroll down then, and on the left, you'll see a 176. That is where we are headed next. And I'm going to read number 176 from the book first. It's a little long. Let me take a drink of water first. All right. As and when the perception of an object arises within you, meet it with the understanding, I am not this. Such ignorant perception will immediately cease. In fact, there is nothing to be known in all this. There is need only to get rid of confusion or deluded understanding. If this delusion is not repeatedly revived, it ceases to be. Whatever notion arises in you, even as movement arises in the wind, realize that I am not this, and thus deprive it of support. This actually reminds me very, very much of the inquiry I went through this morning. Yeah, Ruby's saying yes. It's the same, isn't it, Ruby?
Yeah, it is.
Which some of you may have seen. I posted it on Facebook. I told a story. I started off telling a story. I said that two nights ago, my house was burglarized. And I happened to catch the burglar in the kitchen. And since there are some people wanting a little more detail, I'll give that little more detail right now. What happened when I caught the burglar in the kitchen, there was this knowing. It's funny because I was never fearful. I was never angry. There was nothing like that in this dream, which is kind of funny, with a dream being burglarized. But there was this knowing, and I don't know why, but there was this knowing that I had to break his jaw. So the first thought that showed up in my mind was that I didn't have the strength to break the burglar's jaw. And then the next thought that showed up in the mind was I was not to listen to that thought. And so with great determination, you know, with great willingness to see that I did have the strength to break the jaw, I broke the burglar's jaw. And then I might have even killed him, I'm not certain. And then I woke up. And when I woke up, all there was this absolute knowing that was just a dream. You know, that was all there was. And in fact, what happened in life is I actually just went back to sleep. I only was awake for a moment and saw, oh, that was a dream, and I dozed right back off again. It was not a big deal. So this morning in my inquiry, that memory came up. And there were a lot of questions. Maybe I should just grab my inquiry. No, she never lays there. I don't know what that's about. Yeah. Okay, so here's the questions that came. Here we go. Why did the dream of burglary arise? Why did I break the jaw of the burglar with great determination? And what am I doing by asking these questions? It could be said simply that the dream arose from nothing. It appeared to be, but without reality, and then it disappeared into nothing, having never truly existed in the first place. Or the dream could be said to have some meaning, to have some personal meaning about me, and through the idea of meaning, the dream is afforded some sense of reality, right? As soon as I say, for example, you know, dreams reflect what's in the unconscious. And what's in the unconscious, that's important for me to know about me. But then I give the dream meaning, and I give the dream a sense of reality, right? The dream has something to say about me that I do not know, and it is important that I understand what this dream is trying to say. Oh, Jay's here, so I know Jay understands this thought process. Dreams have been a big part of his life. So again, it could be said simply that the dream arose from nothing. It appeared to be, but without reality. And then it disappeared into nothing, having never truly existed in the first place. Or the dream could be said to have some meaning, to have some personal meaning about me. And through the idea of meaning, the dream is afforded some sense of reality. And in fact, this is kind of funny because when I met Jay, I actually was staying with him. He was my host in Chicago. That's how I met him. And when I was sleeping at his house, I had a dream. And in that dream, Jay was with me. And for some reason, I can't remember the dream as well now. It was a very long time ago, so I'm a little fuzzy on it. But I didn't have clothes. Now, it wasn't that I was naked. I had clothes on. But I was going to something, and I didn't have appropriate clothes for where I was going. And I was in a big hurry. And so Jay took me to this store. And at the store, it was almost like a general store. They had all kinds of things. They had very few clothes, but they had exactly the perfect clothes that I needed for this event. And so I took the clothes, and then the thought entered my mind, I should try them on, make sure they're going to fit. And so there was an Indian man there, and the Indian man there put me on a cart, and he started pushing me really fast and to go to the fitting room to try it on. And Jay's running along beside me. And on the way, there's an accident. The cart hits something or something, and the cart topples, and I fall through a plate glass window and cut my hand and wrist, and it begins to bleed, but the blood is a green ooze. And there's a knowing that I'm going to die. I think I've told you guys this dream before. There's this knowing that I am going to die. But yet I still told the Indian man to call 911. And I could tell he didn't understand and he wasn't going to do it. I said again to call 911, but I just had this acceptance, I'm going to die now. And there was an acceptance of it. That was the dream. And at the time that I had the dream, I think both Jay and I felt the dream had meaning. And I think I looked at the dream a few times. You know, Jay said that the green blood meant healing. I thought that maybe the ego was going to die when I went to India. And in fact, it was kind of funny. When I got to India, I did not have clothes. I had clothes on, but my suitcases didn't make it. And our host, who was an Indian man, did take us to a store that had very few clothes, but had the perfect thing that I needed. So that part of the dream came true. And then when we got in the taxi and we were going to Tiruvannamalai, the taxi, if you've never been to India, riding in a taxi there is quite an experience. And I had the thought that maybe this was the Indian man pushing the cart in the dream because he was going so fast, you know. And I thought maybe this was where the accident was going to happen and I was going to go through the glass of the taxi and die. And of course that never happened. But because of belief that the dream is speaking from the unconscious, that the dream has some meaning, we put meaning to it. But as time can tell, that meaning never happened, and when the meaning never really played out, you know, I kind of forgot about it until just now. And so during the period of time of forgetting about it, it actually did not exist at all. It had no effect after the thinking about it ended and the forgetting about it began. So let me read these last two paragraphs again. It could be said simply that the dream arose from nothing. It appeared to be, but without reality, and then it disappeared into nothing, having never truly existed in the first place. Or the dream could be said to have some meaning, to have some personal meaning about me. And through the idea of meaning, the dream is afforded some sense of reality, which is a statement of direct experience. Now, this is an important question. Which is a statement of direct experience, and which is additional mind action? Now, I told you that when I woke up from this dream about the burglary, the direct experience was, oh, that was just a dream. There was nothing else. There was just an absolute knowing that wasn't real, that didn't happen, and I went right back to sleep. It had no meaning other than not real. But then later, the mind starts wanting to ask. By the way, who started wanting to ask? The mind starts wanting to ask, why did the dream of burglary arise? Why did I break the jaw of the burglar with great determination? Right? The mind starts wanting to analyze that. So which is a statement of direct experience? And which is additional mind action? Now, what I noticed in me, and by the way, I'm noticing this in others too, not just me. Since I posted it on Facebook, I very seldom get any comments or attention on my posts. But today, this post is getting attention. And what's happening is that people are wanting to analyze the dream. And I saw that in me too. There was a wanting to analyze the dream. But what I have learned in my practice is the difference between what I would call guidance and resistance, the feeling of it that inside of me. And I could feel that it was resistance that did not want to accept that the dream was nothing. Resistance wanted to make something of it. I could feel that. So the question I ask next is, why is there resistance to accepting that the dream is nothing? What wants to make more of it and say it has meaning that is real? That became the next question. Why is this here? Why does this resistance want to make more of the dream? Go in and turn it into something. If the force of resistance is followed, the dream is analyzed. Some idea about what I am is developed. It may be good or bad, but either way it defines a truth, in quotes, about what I am. So we could look at the dream and we could say, this is what it means that you dreamt that your house was burglarized. This is what it means that you caught the burglar in the kitchen. This is what it means that you broke his jaw with strong determination, right? We can do that if we want to. And then we are defining, this is what your unconscious is saying about you, Regina. We are defining an individual self. We're saying this is what's true about you that you did not previously know. So if the fourth force of resistance is followed and the dream is analyzed, some idea about what I am is developed. It may be good or bad, but either way it defines a, quote, truth about what I am. If the force of resistance is not followed, and there is no further thought about the dream, there is nothing left of the dream. No effect, no self-identification, nothing, right? Nothing. Therefore, which supports the continuation of the dream as a reality? Obviously, the analysis is what gives it meaning. The belief that the unconscious has something valuable to say supports the idea that the dream had some kind of reality, right? Some kind of meaning. Which supports the continuation of the dream as reality? No more thought about it, or assumed meaning and continued thought? And what is intuitively known about the dream? That it is reality or nothing. And I got to tell you, I know this. If I don't follow that path of resistance into analysis, I know what I knew the instant I woke up. It was nothing. It had no meaning. Now what happens is we have a strong belief in the person. And the unconscious is part of the person. And so we think the unconscious has value, something to communicate, something to share about the person. But if we see that the person is untrue, then the unconscious has no value because it is also untrue. Just like the dream was untrue. By giving the unconscious meaning, we are saying indirectly that the person is real. And I've never seen this until this morning. You know, one of the practices of self-inquiry is something they call neti neti, which is, you know, one by one saying, I'm not that, I'm not that. And up until today, I would have said that the unconscious had value because it has something to say about me. But this morning, what I saw clear as day is, oh my God, when I say that, who am I saying I am? I'm saying I'm the dream character. Now, there was an earlier time when there were a lot of beliefs in me that were very deeply believed, such as the belief in unworthiness. Such as the belief in vulnerability, you know, the belief in the need to defend myself and protect myself. And when those beliefs are in place, I don't think this realization will come. At least it didn't for me. When those beliefs are in place, then there's still I would call a healing of the beliefs that need to occur. A long time ago, way back when I was a student of A Course in Miracles, Spirit gave me a diagram. And the diagram showed the person and the person's unconscious. And then underneath that was what was called the Holy Spirit. And it said, what I was taught at that time was there needed to be some healing of the unconscious so that the Holy Spirit or the clarity could shine up into consciousness. And so if we are thick with beliefs that I'm a person and all of this stuff, well then the unconscious maybe at that point does have some meaning. The unconscious is showing us things that do need to be healed. But when enough of that healing has occurred and the clarity shines up, there comes a point where the clarity dawns, like it did on me this morning, oh my God, I'm not the unconscious. That's not what I am. That's never been what I am. But you can't fake that. So it's kind of like both are true, that there's some healing that needs to occur first. For a while, maybe looking at the unconscious does have some value. But then at some point, when the mind is ready, when the healing has occurred, there's a seeing that is not, that's part of the dream. That's part of the illusory personality. So again, what is intuitively known about the burglary dream? That it is reality or nothing. And what was intuitively known upon awakening is that it is nothing. Upon awakening, it was known that the dream was nothing. Continued thought gives it the illusion of meaning. And continuance, right? Because if I take on the idea, I didn't analyze it, so I don't know. Let's see. If I took on the idea, well, somebody, oh, I don't remember. A couple people actually gave me their interpretations of what it meant, but I don't remember them because I wasn't feeling guided to give that meaning. So, but let's say, you know, the fact that I broke his jaw with determination means something about me. If I take that on, then I have added that to my conscious identity. I'm still holding on to a false self as this is who I am, right? So continued thought gives it the illusion of meaning and continuance. But it is more accurate to say it was nothing. And let all thinking about it stop there. This decision is reflective of truth. It was nothing. Now, with that story told, let's go back and read number 176. Here's what it says. As and when the perception of an object arises within you, meet it with the understanding, I am not this. Such ignorant perception will immediately cease. In fact, there is nothing to be known in all this. There is need only to get rid of confusion or deluded understanding. If this delusion is not repeatedly revived, it ceases to be. Whatever notion arises in you, even as a movement arises in wind, realize I am not this, and thus deprive it of support. So you see, I am not the unconscious. That dream has no meaning, and that is reflective of truth. Now, on the day when I originally contemplated this, it was a different day. I had not yet had the realization I had this morning. So let's go to the journal and see what number 176 meant for me back then. I'm looking at the date now. This was January 30, 2012. And here's what I wrote. When attention strays to thinking, point out to yourself, this thinking is illusion-making. Or point out to yourself, this idea is not real. Or point out to yourself, I am not this character. And then, with love and present understanding desire, return attention to the present still heart. Through this practice of remembering and returning, the ego delusion ends. Well, one thing I talked about last night is that the Seven Steps Journal seems to be putting forth three spiritual practices, one of which clearly is contemplation, another is investigation or inquiry, which I just led you through an example of inquiry, and then the third is remembrance. And what number 176 is talking about is the practice of remembrance. And again, this is a practice that is to go on throughout the day. Just like I mentioned that the Course Workbook is teaching you to use time for awakening, the teachings of Inner Ramana are teaching you to use time for awakening, this practice is using time for awakening. So let's say I'm doing dishes. And let's say my mind makes up a story about Ruby. And at first I'm listening to this story and I'm thinking whatever I'm thinking about Ruby. And then noticing happens. And I notice that I'm off into mind wandering. You know, being tolerant of mind wandering, as Jesus would say. Then what I do is I point out to myself, this thinking about Ruby is illusion making, right? That's what I do. It's that simple. And then there's a stillness that follows because I have just ended the storytelling and I rest within that stillness for a moment. So it's a practice. It's a practice of using time for the purpose of awakening. It's a practice of detaching from the belief that I am that, that this is all real and I am this person in this world. Again, the quote from the Seven Steps to Awakening says, as and when the perception of an object arises within you, meet it with the understanding, I am not this. Such ignorant perception will immediately cease. In fact, there is nothing to be known in all this. Again, if we go back to the analyzing the dream, look what this is saying. You know, we're analyzing the dream saying there's something to be known here. But what the Supreme Yoga is saying, there is nothing to be known in all this. There is need only to get rid of confusion or deluded understanding. The only need is to stop believing the false. That's the only need. If this delusion is not repeatedly revived, if you don't continually go into the analysis of your dreams, or if you don't continually listen to your mind-wandering stories, right? If this delusion is not repeatedly revived, it ceases to be. Whatever notion arises in you, even as movement arises in wind, realize that I am not this, and thus deprive it of support. So back to number 176 in the journal. When attention strays to thinking, point out to yourself, this thinking is illusion making. Or point out to yourself, this idea is not real. Or point out to yourself, I am not this character. And then, with love and present understanding desire, return attention to the present still heart. Through this practice of remembering and returning, the ego delusion ends. All right, so let's scroll down and click on number 177. And I will also post this link in the room, and I'm going to take a water break. I get thirsty sometimes when I talk a lot. Here we go. All right. So we are ready for number 177, and I'm going to read from the Seven Steps to Awakening. Thinking, mental conditioning, and imagination are meaningless and are productive only of psychological distress. All the sorrows and misfortunes of life are rooted in and rest in sense experience and thinking. Again, thinking, mental conditioning, and imagination are meaningless and are productive only of psychological distress. All the sorrows and misfortunes of life are rooted in and rest in sense experience and thinking. All right, let's go to number 177 in the journal. I remember this one. If someone stains your carpet or dents your car, there may be unhappiness. If there is unhappiness, What is the cause of that unhappiness? You see, this is the journal practice called investigation or inquiry. If there is unhappiness, what is the cause of that unhappiness? If you did not see a stain or dent, could you be unhappy? All right, so one thing that the quote said that we were reading in the book, it said, all the sorrows and misfortunes of life are rooted in and rest in, and it gave us two things, sense experience and thinking. So that leads to the first question. What if I didn't see a stain or a dent? Could I be unhappy? So let's imagine that I'm in Israel. Somebody is staying in my house, taking care of Jamie, and that person spills red wine on my carpet, and they are unable to get it up, you know, to the point where there's not a stain. So there's a stain right in the middle of my living room. I'm in Israel. I don't see it. Does it affect my happiness? Of course not. It can't affect my happiness if I do not see it, right? Again, this says, let's see, where are we? We're on number 177. This says, all the sorrows and misfortunes of life are rooted in and rest in, and then it gives us two things, either sense, experience, and thinking. And it's true, if I do not know about it, I do not suffer from it. If I do not see it, hear it, smell it, taste it, feel it, I do not suffer from it. The second question. If you did not define a stain or dent as unacceptable, could you be happy? Even if I do see it. If I've never been taught that there's something wrong with a red stain in the middle of my carpet, would I suffer? I remember when I was in Japan, I was actually a student of Asian studies, and we did a lot of touring as a part of our classes. And I remember visiting pottery places. Pottery is pretty big in Japan. And they would be very expensive. I mean, hundreds of dollars, you know, a bowl, very expensive bowl with a crack in it. And I would say to my teacher, you know, why is this bowl so expensive? It's got a crack in it. It's not any good. Why didn't they throw it out? And she explained to me that the Japanese see differently than we do. They think differently than we do. That crack in that bowl, that is something the artist didn't do. That was something that the universe or the gods or you know, the unseen did the crack. The bowl with the crack in it is actually more valuable than the bowl that the artist did on his own. Now, what if I had been taught that about a stain on the carpet? What if I had been taught that if you have a guest in your house and they happen to spill something and leave a stain, that's an honor. It's like the guest stays forever and they never leave. Right? You know, so if I did not define a stain or dent as unacceptable, could I be unhappy? Next, if you did not identify mine with the carpet or car, would you experience unhappiness? If I'm driving down the street and a dent car passes me on the street, do I suffer from that? Of course not. I don't suffer at all. There's a sense of possessiveness that's required. It's an idea of mine. You know, now that I'm further down the path of this inquiry, one thing that I've seen is that there are several background thoughts that are running all of the time. And in fact, it's actually the running of these background thoughts that creates the perception of the world. And one of those background thoughts that runs, well, one of them is, this is my world. You know, this is me, this body, this personality, this mind, this is me. That is not me. That cup is not me. That microphone is not me. That body is not me, right? And another one is, that which is mine has more value to me than that which is not mine. Possessiveness is a part of the background thought. So if my carpet is stained or my car is dented, I am unhappy. But just because I see a stain or a dent on a carpet that is not mine, you know, I walk into a hallway in some business and there's a stain on the carpet, I'm not unhappy. So if you did not see a stain or dent, could you be unhappy? If you did not define a stain or dent as unacceptable, could you be unhappy? If you did not identify mine with the carpet or car, would you experience unhappiness? The stain or dent, then, is clearly not the cause of unhappiness. What causes unhappiness? What causes unhappiness? And again, from the Seven Steps to Awakening, all the sorrows and misfortunes of life are rooted in and rest in sense experience and thinking. We first have to sense it, and then we have to have ideas about it. It's the sensing, or the body experience, and the ideas, or the interpretation, that cause unhappiness, not the event itself. All right, we have 5 minutes, so let's see if we can get one more done. Let's scroll down and click on number 178. Number 178 in the book says, "The mind is like a forest in spring. It is so dense with very many notions and concepts that dense darkness prevails in it. On account of self-limitation or ignorance, people undergo countless experiences of pleasure and pain in this world." All right, again. "The mind is like a forest in spring. It is so dense with very many notions and concepts that dense darkness prevails in it. On account of self-limitation or ignorance, people undergo countless experiences of pleasure and pain in this world." All right, let's look at number 178 in the journal. "The mind's thoughts are like seeds. They are planted, watered, and nourished through attention. A multitude of plants grow and flourish in the rich soil of mind attention. There is variety, great variety, numerous levels of pleasure, and numerous levels of pain. This is the way it is in the jungle of active attention mind." So, of course, this is describing duality. We are not saying that every thought leads to the experience of pain. There are certainly thoughts that lead to the experience of joy. The thought, "I love you." The thought, "I love this steak. It's a great steak." The thought, "Oh, today is a perfect day." These thoughts do not lead to suffering. But the problem is, if these thoughts are believed to be the cause of joy, well, they all have a flip side. "I love you" turns to, "You don't ever care about me. You don't ever think about me. You don't ever put me first. All you think about is yourself." Right? "This is a great steak" turns to, "Oh my God, we've been sitting in this restaurant for 50 minutes. They haven't brought us a thing yet. And then when they do bring it, my steak is burnt." Right? "And this is a great day, a perfect day" turns into, "Oh my God, all it does is rain around here. Or it's way too hot and dry around here. Or there's too many moths around here. I can't stand the moths. Or I hate the wind." Right? If we believe and are attached to the thoughts, it is true that some of the thoughts seem to bring pleasure, but also some of them bring pain. We are within duality. We cannot have consistent happiness with thoughts. Consistent happiness comes from realizing that is before thought, precedes thought, that beingness that is unaffected by thought. By identifying with that, then it's okay if the steak is perfectly cooked, and it's okay if the steak is burnt. It's okay if the day is the temperature that we like it. It's okay if the day is a different temperature from our preference. It's just as okay. The preferences may still exist, but somehow the happiness doesn't shift and change based on whether we're getting our preference or not. The happiness is consistent. So the mind's thoughts are like seeds. They are planted, watered, and nourished through attention. A multitude of plants grow and flourish in the rich soil of mind attention. There is variety, great variety, numerous levels of pleasure, and numerous levels of pain. This is the way it is in the jungle of active attention mind. And I am out of time. I will be back next Sunday night, and we will continue with the seven steps then. All right, thank you so much. Bye.